offering a most loving pranam Jai Bhagwan's lotus feet. Dear listeners, we welcome you to this week's episode of Afternoon Satsang. And after a break of a few weeks, we are happy to join you all again live from our studios at Prashanthi Nilayam. This is Prem, and with me is Arvind, and we can't tell you how delighted we are to join you all again after this short break, and hopefully we will not have any more breaks. We are here to resume our satsang in the Sanatan Sarthi series that we have been doing. The last time around, I think it's about more than 4 or 5 weeks ago, we were doing the August edition of 1958 Sanatan Sarthi. We will be continuing with that here. But even before we get into that, let's invite Arvind to join all of us. Sairam, Arvind.
Sairam, Prem, and Sairam to all our listeners. And as Prem said, it's definitely a joy to be back, indulging in satsang, thinking of Swami, and, you know, reminding each other of Swami, filling our lives with Swami. For what else is the purpose and meaning of life other than Swami? In fact, that is the message too that will get highlighted repeatedly in today's satsang, because that is the subject of two discourses that Bhagwan delivered, the two discourses which we had promised last time that we would be taking up in the next coming satsang, and this happens to be that next coming satsang. But you know, before we dive into that, I think Prem, we'll just let our listeners know that this week and the next will possibly be the last weeks with this kind of timing for a Thursday live program. The other way of putting it would be, starting from October 8th, Thursday, we will have a new format for the Thursday live, with, of course, all your favorite programs coming with slightly deferred timings. So with respect to Afternoon Satsang, the timings will be from 12 to 1:30.
Right, so we still remain in the afternoon, but we are going to come to you a little earlier than we've been coming to in the past 8 years. This is the 8th year of the Afternoon Satsang, so a slight change in schedule. And as Arvind said, we're not going to drop any of your programs, because most of the other programs too are following some series. The Vahini Satsang is going through a series, and the Telugu, the Vedavit Jignasa, all those programs will be there, but a slight change time schedule. We'll not tell you all the time schedules. Please stay tuned to our social media channels. We will put out the schedule very shortly, and maybe next week we will tell you clearly what are the changes that are going to be, so that you will accordingly change your schedule. And there will also be something new coming up. We'll leave that for next week.
Yes. And with that, we will dive into the discourse that Bhagwan delivered at Gudur in the Nellore district of Andhra Pradesh on the 25th of July, 1958. In the previous satsang, we had spoken in detail about Bhagwan's travels through the district of Nellore. And though it is summarized as a one-week travel through Nellore, the number of places that Swami visited, which we highlighted last time, more than 8 to 9 towns and villages in a span of 6 days, which means at times Swami was covering two places in the same day. And almost every place Swami delivered a discourse or a mini discourse, so much so that Professor Kasturi, I think, at that time has been able to document just a couple of them, or right, one of them, the opening discourse.
In fact, I was talking to the Telugu team. Mm-hmm. They apparently visited the house in Gandavaram or Gandavaram, as one of the towns that we went through, just about a few kilometers away from Nellore. So one of the places where Swami visited, one of the devotees' houses where Swami visited, they went to that particular house, and even as they were talking to the person, elderly gentleman in the house, who was a 7-year-old boy when Swami visited in 1958, mm-hmm, and the very chair which Swami was seated on was there. And he was saying that Swami spent not even half a day in that town, and in that he gave a discourse, and the discourse was maybe 15-20 minutes or some duration such as that, of course without the translation, because those were all Telugu-speaking audience. So many of those discourses were like that, very crisp. Swami must have just gone, given a discourse, and moved on to the next village.
And this happens to be possibly, as Prem said, a big kind of a formal right discourse. But again, I don't know if this had a translator there, because
true,
it is the same language of the heart and same language of the tongue as well. So Bhagwan as documented in the Sathya Sai Speaks, Swami begins the discourse by saying that any fruit has to grow and ripen before its sourness turns into sweetness. And then Swami says, I have been to this town for more than 10 years. So, means in the last 10 years, I have been visiting this town multiple times. But it looks like this town had to wait for 10 years before I could deliver my discourse. And I think that's the most apt analogy, because listening to Swami speak is like getting a flow of nectar, of getting a flow of joy. How much ever we discuss what Swami spoke, I don't think we will be able to recreate even a little bit of how it must have been to actually listen to Swami. Because, you know, anytime a person or anybody speaks, the words that are spoken constitute, I think, only a small part of what is being conveyed. So much more is conveyed by what the person exudes. And this is something we have observed when we see, say, somebody from Russia or somebody from Latin America sitting and enjoying Swami's discourses, though they know nothing of Telugu and nothing of English. That's because they are receiving a message that is being emitted from Bhagwan even without the words. And I think that is a more powerful message than actual words. So while here we are discussing the words, the persona of Bhagwan, his presence there, you know, such sweetness and such love, even if I don't understand what Swami is speaking, when Swami would speak Telugu, my heart would jump in joy. And I'm sure this is the experience for many others too. So it must have been such a divine delight for all those people. And that's why Swami says that it has come, in Hindi they say, you know, der aaye par durust aaye. Even though it comes late, when it comes, it's amazing. And that's how is the condition there. Though Swami has visited there, he has never delivered a public discourse, and it's the first time he's delivering, and it's all sweetness. And Swami says, yes, patience definitely brings its fruits, which are very sweet.
Even as you were saying, you know, words are one way in which Swami communicated to us, and the same analogy of the fruit, the raw fruit becoming the sweet, tender fruit that is ripened. I think that's what exactly Swami does with each one of our minds, but through words is only one of the ways by which it is achieved. Ever so often, when I'm coming towards the ashram, I sometimes bump into our Ramakrishna Reddy sir, one of the senior most teachers from our school, who's been around from the early 50s and 60s. So he was sharing a very interesting thing, you know, when we were discussing about the construction work which was happening in the ashram and how a lot of devotees participated in it. He said, you know, you one look at it, you know that the work which was being done by devotees could have been got done by Swami in a week by hiring the right kind of people. You know, you just get some able-bodied laborers and in no time it will be done. And it was not such an expensive affair also. I mean, it is not like Swami was trying to save money by getting devotees to work. But the very fact, you know, you would see that his own grandmother, who was 80 plus, the joy that she would get and just sit in some corner, and she could not even carry the load. You know, she would just be in one corner.
Reddy sir's grandmother.
Reddy sir's grandmother. You know, he would say that she would be sitting in some corner and polishing a tile which has been laid, or, you know, breaking a tile which is about to be set, just chanting Swami's name. Right? And you would say that the one moment you look at them and you know that how much Swami is doing just by giving this small opportunity. And you look around, the people who are so simple. You know, today when you go through this discourse, it's so profound. For some of us who have been reading spiritual literature for quite some time, you can still look at this and there is so much to learn, so much to gather. Mm. But this is a discourse that Swami is delivering to simple village folk. Right? And Swami prepared their minds for 10 years, he says, I've been coming here and today I'm speaking to you. 10 years by merely his presence, by merely just coming and visiting them, Swami has prepared them for this message that Swami is giving, which is so profound. There's no dilution in what Swami is saying here. Swami is not saying, you're not city or you're not people who have been reading spiritual literature, so let me tone it down for you. No, it is the full message in its full flow and grandeur. And so beautifully encapsulated in that analogy that for 10 years, your mind has been being prepared for this moment to receive.
In fact, Swami then begins by saying that what I'm going to tell is nothing new.
Right.
Because it is the Sanatana wisdom. It is a wisdom that is eternal. In fact, I remember these two terms that would be used for Swami's discourses. Nityanutana Satya Sanatana. Meaning, his message is the eternal truth. Satya Sanatana means the truth eternal. But yet it is Nityanutana. It is ever new, because when you listen to it, you feel refreshed and you feel, wow, you seem to derive insights, ideas and thoughts which you never knew existed possibly or never felt it before. So, Swami Bhatt makes it very clear. He says that what I am saying is nothing new, because all spiritual disciplines are ancient as time itself. But then, what is new today is man's behavior. Man's behavior keeps changing and it becomes new. And that is why whenever this thing happens, when the behavior changes for the worse, man's behavior has to be brought back to the path. And it is for that reason that God comes, the advent happens. And Swami says, my advent is to address this. So in a way, Swami is also saying that the Lord comes to do this. And I have come to do this, which means it's very evident for even those who have not yet realized it thus far, that it's the Supreme Lord who has come to deliver the eternal message, but in a new manner, in a style that we possibly can understand, so that we can benefit from it, change our behaviors, and achieve happiness and peace.
Right, and so wonderfully Swami says, you know, he says, man's capacity, man's nature, man's talents, and his true possessions have never changed. Right? Swami would say, what is true is what is eternal within. So that has not changed. And because this has not changed, the way to utilize them, that message has also not changed. And that is why my message is eternal. And interestingly, if you recall, we were going through the discourses that Swami gave as part of the trip to Africa. Mm-hmm. And I think on returning from Africa, the discourse that Swami gives, Swami alludes to one of the points the speaker before him says, that, you know, it was so heartening to see people of the African origin coming into the Sai fold. Mm. And in response to that, Swami said, I don't know what Sai fold he's talking about. And Swami said, my message is eternal. I've not come to start anything new or say anything new.
Mm.
And very interesting that Swami is starting that by saying that this message is new, but it has to be said in a different way, because as Swami would say, Kali Prabhavam, right? The times change, and with times, man's perversions and man's distractions change, and accordingly the message has to be reiterated, and that is the role of the avatar.
And as if to prove, you know, what he said is the truth, Swami makes a statement which I'm sure would have struck a chord with all the people in the village there, and I'm sure will strike a chord to anybody who is reading it, whether you are a poor man or a rich man, or whether you are a student or whether you are an elderly person, whatever be your social status, whatever be your age, whatever be your position in society, this is something true, what Swami alludes to. Swami says that, you know, irrespective of your worldly achievement, irrespective of it, there is a sense of dissatisfaction. Whatever you may achieve, the extent of the achievement may vary in each one's perspective. Some may feel that possibly getting 1 million rupees is the greatest wealth. Somebody else may feel 100 million is the greatest wealth. Somebody may feel that marrying a woman of your choice or a man of your choice is the greatest joy. Whatever. And if that is done, there's nothing else left in life for me to do. Many times we have got this feeling. And the very fact that we have got this feeling many times in our life shows that this is a very temporary feeling. You know, when I'm studying for my board exams, I just feel that if I get top class marks in the board exam, that's it. My life is set. I don't need anything else in life. And one day after I've got my results as per my liking, I have got some new wish already, new desire already. So Swami says that there is a sense of dissatisfaction irrespective of what you achieve. And Swami says the only way to remove this sense of dissatisfaction is for you to discover where you have come from, where you are journeying, and what is this journey's end going to be. And Swami says, this discovery alone can end this dissatisfaction that you feel. And as I said, I'm sure this dissatisfaction is common across the people in the village, the people in the town, the people in cities, people in developed countries, wherever you are, in whatever position in life. And Swami says, for this discovery, for this journey of self-discovery, where did I come from, where am I journeying, what is my journey's end, you need discrimination.
Right, and the point that Swami is making is very profound, and we have spoken about this before also. This satisfaction is not an anomaly, right? Oftentimes we say that this discontent, oh, I'm not contented. What Swami is saying here is very interesting. He's saying it's built into the makeup of a human nature. And the statement that Swami makes is, you know, there is this unslaked thirst, for one is a child of immortality and feels that death cannot be the end, right? It is like you have this huge pit, a bottomless pit, and you're trying to gather everything from the world and trying to fill that pit. Swami says it will not get filled because by nature this pit is bottomless, and by nature whatever you're dropping into that is limited. Only that which is unlimited can fill this unlimited pit. Mm. Right? So Swami says this world which is anitya will never be able to satisfy this craving which is nitya actually. This craving is for that which is immortal, that which is eternal. So Swami says eventually you will turn to God. And the interesting thing is, you know, one of the students who had been to Kodaikanal with Swami, he was saying this, you know, when asked about what did you learn from a trip with Swami like that to Kodaikanal. And I think Swami would have been there for 10 or 20 days or something. And he said, apart from the fact that it was a wonderful trip and you could spend so much time with Swami and all of that, he said, there are two things which probably people will not talk much about. He says, two kinds of vairagyas will come in you. One is vairagya for food, because you're being fed so much.
Sumptuously.
Right? And second, he said, the vairagya for Swami's form. You said, you're spending so much time with Swami, you're sitting right in front of Swami, but you feel that you have not got him. You're feeling that you're not getting what Swami really is. Because you would say, Swami sometimes would sit there and not talk anything. Swami would just be sitting there. You know, you'll be looking at Swami, yes, for the first 5-10 minutes you'll be thrilled that I'm getting such good darshan. But after that, you know, boredom is part of the human mind. You leave that opportunity with a sense that I have not grasped fully what Swami was there to give. Right? And that turns you within, that turns you to look at Swami in a more deeper way, you know, go beyond that form. So I think that's like probably the greatest sense of dissatisfaction that you'll feel. God is right in front of you and still you're dissatisfied. Which means what you have to get has to be beyond the physical.
If we take it by default that God is ananta, meaning infinite, he is limitless. The very fact, as you said, that God is in front and I'm not feeling that, means that what I'm considering as God is possibly not,
right,
not the way God is supposed to be perceived. That is not God. I mean, very, very easy, and very often we make this mistake of assuming that physical frame to be God. I mean, it is divine, but that is as divine as your physical frame, my physical frame, any physical frame. But to actually catch hold of God means to be in that state of limitless joy, limitless peace. And for that, Swami says, discrimination is absolutely necessary. And then, you know, Swami goes on to say why this discrimination doesn't happen. He says that there are three kinds of intellects that you find. You know, intellect is supposed to be charged with the ability to discriminate. But Swami says the intellect itself can be tamasic, it can be rajasic or sattvic. What's a tamasic intellect? A tamasic intellect is one that gets confused between what is real and what is unreal. Okay. It doesn't, you know, Swami would many times in his discourse make a statement where he would say that whatever that appears real is unreal. Whatever that appears unreal is real. You know, when you think of this, it's like, hey, no, what is real is unreal. What is unreal is real. It's so confusing. You know, when you are confused like that, Swami says that's a tamasic intellect. Then Swami says there's a rajasic intellect which knows what is truth and untruth, but keeps swinging between truth and untruth. You know, you may be convinced that all these things worldly are of no use at all. Deep down you know it. You know it's not going to give you satisfaction, because possibly you have experienced it multiple times, and you know that despite experiencing it multiple times, how it has led you to a void. And yet when you clamor after it, I think that's a kind of rajasic intellect wherein you know what is you know what is the truth, you know what is the untruth, and yet you keep swinging based on your moods and emotions. And finally, Swami says there's a sattvic intellect which knows the difference between truth and untruth and puts in all effort to stick only to the truth. And then Swami also goes on to say, today the world is predominantly rajas. And rajas is explained by extremely strong likes and dislikes. So Swami says that, I think that's a compliment also in a sense, that the world is not tamas today, because tamas is supposed to be the worst stage to be in. Rajas, the world is very passionate, the world is very energetic, it has very strong likes and dislikes. So it has to move from this rajasic intellect to the sattvic intellect in order to be able to achieve discrimination, which is necessary for discovering one's true identity.
Yeah, oftentimes Swami would say this in discourses. He would start saying this, which would appear like a compliment, but then Swami would put the people in place in sense. Swami would say, look at our students, they know everything. Swami would start like that, and then Swami would say, but they don't follow it. Right? Kani, and then he'll say that, but they don't follow it. And I think that is the definition of this rajasic discrimination that Swami is saying. You know, Swami, I think in another discourse explains this, rajasic, tamasic and sattva. Rajasic is, there also you're actually clear. Rajasic and sattva, you're clear. In tamasic and sattvic, you're actually clear. In tamasic, you're clear that you have believed the untrue to be true. Mm-hmm. You believe the world to be true. You believe the happiness of the world to be true happiness. So you're only pursuing that. Right, and that's a path to further getting deluded. Right,
that way Swami calls them as confused.
Right,
souls.
Confused. Like they're very clear that spirituality is not worth following, and they get lost in the world. The rajasic is, I think, all of us will fall into that category because we are informed. Right, it's not that we don't know. We've been informed. We've had good company. We've had the company of Swami. We've heard it from Swami that this world is unreal. But then at that moment you forget it. At that moment when there is pain, you seek solace. At a moment when you're in pain, you want relief from that pain. You want that craving to be satisfied. So at that moment you forget what is real and unreal. And you keep, you know, dwindling from this and that. When everything is calm, you're able to think of spirituality. And then third, Swami says, the sattvic who is very clear. This is what I need to follow and this is what I follow. And Swami says that leads to a certain sense of equanimity. Because you're not disturbed. You're not disturbed by onset of unpleasant happenings.
By the consequences.
Right. And that makes you equanimous. And Swami says when God comes, the next point which Swami says is that. When he talks about his materializations and his gifts. He says that when you hear about Swami, when you look at Swami, you think Swami materializes objects. Swami cures people. Swami removes maladies. But what I am doing is not giving any of these things or granting relief. I am actually leading you towards that equanimous state. It's a very, very profound point that Swami is giving. Because we always think of Swami as, you know, the miracle man and the person who satisfies our desires.
Hmm.
So Swami says, yes, it might appear that I'm satisfying desires, but what I'm actually doing is leading you towards that state of equanimity, which is what truly you deserve.
We hear that famous and popular quote from Bhagwan, which is, I give you what you ask so that one day you will ask what I have come to give. In that discourse at Gudur on the 25th of July 1958, Swami makes a similar statement. Swami says, I confer on you these boons of health and prosperity, but only so that you might, with greater enthusiasm and with less interruption, proceed with your spiritual practice. So it's almost like I am doing all this so that you don't face any obstacle in your spiritual practice and you find greater enthusiasm in your spiritual practice. And if we look at our own life's frame, this is what it is. You know, Swami, through an act of grace which conferred on us possibly a worldly reward, we are enthused into a spiritual life. You know, in a very funny manner in the hostel, we used to call it as AIDS, AIDS, meaning acquiring intense devotion suddenly. And you would notice this happening when Swami calls a boy and speaks to him and possibly gives him an interview or materialize a ring or a chain, however talkative that boy is, however possibly ill-behaved or rough or whatever it is, that boy gets into an introspection mode, immediately becomes silent, you know, starts becoming very courteous towards the teachers, tries to become loving towards the other boys in the room. Of course, this effect might wear off if for the next 1 month Swami doesn't speak to him again. That effect might wear off and he might return to normalcy. But definitely for a short period after that interaction with Bhagwan, all this would happen. And I think that itself is a practical demonstration of how Swami does this. Like Swami speaking to us or Swami giving a ring or a chain or giving an interview. These are not spiritual gifts directly per se. But they inspire us, you know, to listen to what is Swami's teaching, try to follow it with more earnestness and try to keep away from what Swami says are not good for us. So therefore, indirectly, these become spiritual gifts. Otherwise, a ring or a chain or some vibhuti, holy ash, these are not, as I said, directly spiritual gifts. But because they inspire you and motivate you onto the spiritual path, they become spiritual gifts. And that's what Swami is saying. I confer these boons only so that you may proceed on the spiritual practice with greater enthusiasm and less interruption.
Right, and thereafter he goes on to give a very crisp explanation of, you know, the journey that Swami starts us off in this process of coming into our life, in the process of, as you said, giving us these various gifts, catching our attention, so to say. Swami says it starts with that inculcation of bhakti. Starts with devotion, and that bhakti will lead to shakti, Swami says. That shakti is that firmness to walk on the spiritual path, and that power will grant you yukti, right? That that ability will give you that focus to stay on the path, if we could put it that way. And then Swami goes on to say, that skill will help you to fix your attachment or rakti on the proper objects, which is that which is true and not which is untrue. And your devotion thus promoted finally results in mukti. Right? So Swami says that it is not, it should not stop at that age, as you said, right? There is that inspiration of devotion that Swami creates, that ripple of devotion Swami creates through his activities. That bhakti should translate into shakti, go on into yukti, and then rakti leading to mukti.
It reminds me of this, I don't know if I'm pronouncing it right, a gyroscope. It's a kind of a toy, which is like a ball. And inside it, there is a gyrating kind of sphere.
Okay.
Okay. I don't know if I'm getting the exact term. Basically, you have to rotate your wrist with a lot of force to get it started. And when it starts, basically it's one heavy ball rotating clockwise, another rotating anti-clockwise, and the momentum of each other sustains the other, that kind of. So, you know, you almost feel as if you're holding a revolving planet in your hand once it's you get it going. But many times you just can't get that ball rolling, so you put in a thread and you crank it and then start rotating it firmly with your wrist to sustain it. In fact, the momentum generated is so much that once you generate it and you hand it over to somebody, if their hand is also not rotating in anticipation of this gyroscope toy coming into their hand, it often shoots out of their hand and falls down as well. So I just felt that it takes a lot of time to learn this technique. But once you learn that technique, you know, you can help others. You know, I remember my two cousins, they were struggling. So I would hold the gyroscope, start it for them and hand it to them. Sustaining it is a little easier than getting it started. But even sustaining it requires effort and focus from your side. Why I told this whole thing is that is what came in my mind when I thought of what Swami did through these interviews or this boost. When Swami says that bhakti, he gives you that initial push that gets you started. Otherwise, we will never be able to start on our own. It is so difficult. It looks so discouraging. But what Swami does is he accelerates it and gives you a taste of the results that you will experience when you follow it. though you are not qualified for it, though you don't deserve it, he just confers it on you, you know. Like if you imagine Prahlad, I mean Dhruva, meditating for years to get a glimpse of the Lord, and we simply get it free. Not only darshan, we get sparshan, sambhashan free. He comes, and I'm not meaning only in the physical sense. Swami has come to people in their dreams and given them experiences that require a lot of penance to achieve. By giving them the taste, I feel it's like he's starting it and giving and saying, now your task, it's not as if that your job is easy. It requires effort even to maintain it. But that much effort you can put. Starting it is tough. I've done it for you. Now you maintain it. And I feel with Swami, how many ever times we take the gyroscope in our hand and it comes to a halt, he takes it and restarts it and again gives it to us till we learn how we can sustain it. So that finally one day we learn to keep it permanently going. You know, that is the kind of love, divine love that we all have received and are receiving. And I think for that we should be really grateful. Otherwise, you know, where we can inculcate bhakti? The very fact that, you know, sometimes I feel that the love that I feel for Swami in my heart, that is also His blessing. You know, otherwise there are so many distractions for the mind. You can simply get easily lost anywhere. But by giving that bhakti and giving shakti to that bhakti, you know, Swami puts us on the path to mukti, as He beautifully says in this discourse.
I'm not able to resist myself by quoting, but what Swami is saying here, since I'm just going through the Bhagavad Gita for the other program, this is exactly what Swami Krishna says in the 6th chapter of Bhagavad Gita, you know, where He says that those people who have led a good life, they've led a moral life, eventually slowly start turning to God for their needs. Right? Apart from working their own way through their needs, they also start turning to God. You know, a farmer turns to God for rain, parents turn to God for their children. So Krishna says that this is not wrong. They turn to God because they have led good lives. And when they turn to God, even though I am not here to bestow only that, He says that I give them the faith that their prayers will be answered. And through that faith that I grant them, I give them the opportunity to turn to me and ask for me. Right? So when Swami is saying here, I'm not giving you rings or chains, I'm not giving you success in business or relief from your maladies, I'm giving you something that is going to lead you to equanimity. This is precisely what Krishna says in that chapter. He says, I lead everyone from that state of an arti to artharti, leading to a jnani. So when Swami says that this is eternal wisdom that I'm going to speak of you, many people have spoken about this. And I think Swami is saying that even I have spoken about this many thousand years ago. I'm just repeating what I've said. Right? And then actually Swami goes on to again give a very beautiful, very simple 4 or 5 steps that leads you on the spiritual path. Swami says the first step into inquiring into the self is the practice of truth. Right? So Swami says start with truth in spoken word. And then Swami says that the very famous dictum from the Bible, in fact it is predated, it predates even the Bible, do unto others what you wish others do unto you. So Swami says, whatever gives you pain, understand that it gives pain to others also. Whatever gives you joy, understand it gives joy to others also. Remembering that, accordingly you lead your life. Swami says, when you do this, there will be a reciprocal relationship that builds between you and people around you. And gradually you will reach a stage where you will very spontaneously exult when someone else is happy. Very spontaneously you will feel pain and empathy when somebody else is in pain. And Swami will say that this will become so spontaneous that it will not have boundaries of relationship. It is not that only your child is going to give you that pain. It is not that a success of your, you know, your sibling or your son is going to give you joy. Anybody's joy will become your joy. So Swami says that will happen, and then this will eventually lead you to the idea that you are all droplets in a large ocean. And that is the relationship which you hold with others, and that is the relationship that you hold with God.
Absolutely. In fact, he clarifies that this is not like how you feel pain when your friend is feeling pain.
Right.
Or how a brother may feel pain when a sister is going through pain. It's not like that. It is not attachment. But the knowledge of a wave, that it is part of the ocean. And that knowledge which also brings the truth that waves are just temporary manifestations of the ocean. I'm a part of the ocean, but as a wave, I'm only temporary. You know, that brings, in fact, it reminds me of one Sanskrit quote that keeps coming again and again in that famous Shankaracharya movie in Sanskrit.
Mm-hmm.
It says, Akashat patitam toyam, sagaram pratigacchati. It means that raindrops that fall from the sky move towards the ocean. You know, it looks like a very prosaic statement of a fact. But in his discourses, Bhagwan has repeated this with its complete entirety multiple times. Swami would say, Akashat patitam toyam, yatha gacchati sagaram, sarvadeva namaskaram, keshavam pratigacchati. Swami would say, just like any drop of water that falls from the sky goes towards the ocean, in the same way, all the salutations or the respect or the love that you offer towards any being goes towards Keshava, meaning the Lord. And after that, you know, Swami would say, Sarvadeva tiraskaram Keshavam pratigacchati, meaning not just the love and salutation that you offer, the respect that you offer, the criticism, the hatred, the jealousy, all the vices that you offer towards anyone also goes towards the Lord. So, as you said, Swami says that you need to develop that discrimination and that kind of focus on the truth. Focus on the Atma alone. Focus on the Atma. And for that, the first step in inquiring is the practice of the truth. That whatever gives you pain, gives others pain. Whatever gives you joy, gives others joy.
Right. And the same thing Swami encapsulates in two very beautiful statements. Swami says, be a bee drinking the nectar of every flower, not the mosquito drinking blood and distributing disease in return.
Mm-hmm.
Very beautifully put. And then Swami, another wonderful statement Swami makes is, love and you will be loved in return. Hate will never be your lot if you promote love and look upon all with love. That is the one lesson I teach always. Mm. That is my secret too, Swami says. And that's some of the wonderful points that Swami makes in that. I think thereafter Swami gives a few instructions to students specifically, students and youngsters.
And then to parents.
And to parents. Maybe we'll come to that after a short break. Dear listeners, don't go away. For those of you who have joined us a little late, this is not a rebroadcast. We are finally back to our live satsang. So we'll take a short break. On the other side of it, we'll continue discussing about this discourse that Swami gave in the year 1958. And during his visits to the district of Nellore in Andhra then.
Krishna Guna.
Welcome back, dear listeners. We are discussing the discourse that Bhagwan delivered on the 25th of July 1958 at Guduru in the Nellore district. And we have finished quite a large chunk of it. Towards the end, Swami says that I shall give you simple remedies for the ills that you are suffering from. And then Swami goes on to say, now we have so many students here who are listening to the discourse, and you know, how do you judge that a student is successful or not? And Swami says you should never judge a student based on the marks or the salary that is secured after they graduate and, you know, join a job. Instead, any student is to be judged on the wisdom and humility that they embody and how much ability they have in distinguishing between the momentary and the momentous. Wow, I think that must be Kasturi sir's contribution.
Right.
Terrific way of putting it. Swami says that they must have the ability to distinguish between what is momentary and what is momentous, what is lasting and what is effervescent. So basically the discrimination between what is permanent and what is temporary. Swami says how successfully a student is able to do that, that is what should be the parameter based on which you judge a student. And then Swami also says one of the most important qualities for a student is to respect the sacrifices made by the parents, especially the mother. In fact, Swami there narrates the story that he has narrated multiple times after that, even as late as the 1990s and the 2000s, when we sat and heard Bhagwan's discourse, Swami would narrate the story of that boy, I think, during the Burma war, Swami would say, one of those wars when this boy is begging, he's near a rich man's door and the rich man is neglecting. Finally, irritated with the boy, the man gets him thrown and he collapses and falls unconscious near a gutter. The rich man is possibly scared or he wonders what happens. He comes and he sees that the boy is mumbling something. So he asks for food to be brought. But the boy continues to mumble and Swami, you know, Swami would get tears in his eyes. And Swami's voice would choke as he would reveal what that little boy was saying. And Swami would say that the boy was going on saying, Modati Ammaku, first to my mother, first to my mother. And Swami would say how this is a poor family where the mother is begging so that she can feed her child. And the child is begging so that the mother need not go hungry. And, you know, Swami would almost break down while saying that the child passed away there. And the number of times, and this is for the first time I'm discovering that Swami narrated the story as early as 1958 as well.
Right.
And in 2008, as Swami is narrating it, it just shows that 60 years have passed, but on the physical frame of the avatar, that story has not lost its impact. Swami says, that is the kind of love with which you have to serve your mother, even if it means having to give up your life, give it up so that she is kept happy, healthy and well nourished.
In fact, while going through the story, it's slightly different from the ones which Swami used to narrate later.
Mm.
As I think later Swami would say that the rich man calls him and offers him food. Then the boy says, no, I want to take it away with me. So the rich man thinks that maybe this boy wants to sell the food away. And he's mumbling that, I have to feed my mother first. The beautiful thing about this narration is, at the end, Swami makes one statement which is so profound.
Mm.
Swami says, this is how parents have to be served. This is what they deserve, Swami says. It is not just that it is your role to do that. This is how much of reverence your parents have deserved for bringing you up.
Mm.
And so beautiful, as you're saying, that if it's a story that has impacted Swami so deeply, and it is a story which impacts the listeners so deeply, that from 58 to the times when we heard Swami narrate the story, Swami has said it, and we don't know with what emotion Swami said it, but we've seen every time Swami narrated it when we were students, the kind of deep impact with which Swami would say it. It's really a beautiful story, and Swami says that this is one of the most important things. In going through this instruction that Swami is giving students, I think this is the essence of what is expected of an educated person according to Bharatiya tradition.
Matra Devo Bhava, Pitru Devo Bhava.
Yeah, even the one that Swami was saying before, Swami would say, Vidya Dadati Vinayam and Sa Vidya Ya Vimuktaye.
Mm.
Only that is education. If education is not making you humble, there's something wrong in the way you've gathered or you've learned or you've gathered knowledge. Similarly, that education should make you be able to discriminate. Today, our education is, you know, we are already tamasic from the discrimination, tamasic discrimination that Swami spoke about. It is only making us more equipped in that tamasic discrimination. You know, we have already decided that this is what I need to pursue. It only enables you to pursue that more and get more lost in that. So Swami is saying that true education should make you discriminate rightly and should make you humble. Again, these are statements which have remained, whether it was in the 2000s when Swami was speaking to students, Swami would speak the same thing. So eternal advice from Swami in that sense.
In fact, you know, where Swami is speaking about respecting the sacrifice of the parent, especially the mother, Swami gives a beautiful interpretation for the ceremony which we conduct called the Shraddham, or the after the parents have departed every year. I think once the parent passes on, for about 11 days continuously, there are different things that are organized as part of a ceremony, bereavement ceremony. After that, it's done on a monthly basis. And after a year passes, yearly it is done, you know, yearly remembrance kind of in honor of the dead parents. Swami says, instead of doing any ceremony, just shed a tear of gratitude on that day. And that is what is most important. And Swami says that this gratitude and tear is not what your parents are looking for. It is for your own benefit. That is what will make you truly humble. That is what will make you, what you say, they say, Vidya Dadati Vinayam, Vinayam Dadati Patratam. Means, Vidya, education gives you humility. Humility gives you deservedness. That deservedness you will get by expressing gratitude. You become worthy vessels to hold, you know, the divine treasure. And for your sake, not for your parents' sake, for your sake, express gratitude. And I think many of our alumni brothers also, you know, have had this beautiful experience wherein Swami says all you need to do to express your gratitude of your parents who have passed on is to remember them with gratitude and shed a tear for them.
In fact, an episode that we've heard many times from Brother Satyajit, he says about his mother would come, you know, that was a time when he was serving Swami and like all his time would be spent inside Swami's mandir. So he said the only time he would get to meet his parents is if they come to Prashantinilayam. When Swami is giving darshan, he couldn't meet his mother. Right? Mm. So his mother had to literally forego that opportunity of sitting in the mandir so that she can come and meet her son. And Swami had also permitted that. Swami had said that, you know, you go and meet her and come. It so happened that once she came during a time when Swami was extremely busy. I think it was during the Dashara season, which is coming. So he could hardly come out and make time to meet her. So after 2 or 3 days, finally he came out and he met his mother. And then his mother literally, you know, she became emotional and he said, 2 days and you never came out and I couldn't see you. So he, you know, he flared up and he gave her a discourse on how she should overcome attachment. Right? Mm. She said, what is this? Swami is here. You should be attached to Swami. How come you're attached to your son still? And, you know, gave her a huge discourse and in the process ended up making her cry more. And he triumphantly returned in his own description back to Swami's mandir. He said when he came back, that day he got the firing of his life from Swami. Swami was extremely unhappy with him and Swami said, how dare you tell your mother that she cannot be attached to you? Swami said, you do not have that right. Mm. Right? Swami has the right to tell us, you know, that you should not be attached. Swami said, a son does not have that right to tell the mother. Swami said, she has every right over you. She can be attached over you. She can demand out of you. And Swami said, I do not approve of what you've done. Right? So he said, see, that is the level of gratitude that literally Swami saying that you first please them and then you come and please me if you really wish to please me. An episode we've heard many times.
And after telling this, you know, Swami also goes on to advise the parents. Swami says that this is the way the children are supposed to treat their parents. How are the parents supposed to treat the children? Swami says that parents must consider children as gifts from God given in their custody. They are just trustees taking care of these children. Swami says, tend to the little souls that are born in your households, just as a gardener tends to the trees in the garden of the master. These don't belong to you. But you need to lovingly tend and care for them, water them, nourish them. And that's again a very important message. Like you said just now, the son doesn't have the right to tell the mother to be detached, but Swami is saying to the parents also, treat this as God's property, not as your personal property. In that, there is the message of detachment. There is also the message of true love.
Right. And another beautiful statement Swami says in advice to parents is, Swami says, you never know. Among this gathering which is sitting here, there might be Tyagarajas and Vivekanandas. So literally Swami is saying that if you find a spark of spiritual inquisitiveness or spiritual longing, Swami says, nurture it. Right? You never know. You could, by your act of nurturing it, you might make a person as noble as Vivekananda, Tyagaraja. And that lies in your hands. So a wonderful advice to students, at the same time, a beautiful advice to parents as well. And with that, Swami concludes with a wonderful statement in the end about himself. So in fact, Swami says it that way. He says, and lastly, about myself. Swami says, and he goes on to say, no one can understand my mystery. The best you can do is to get immersed in it. It is of no use your arguing about pros and cons. Dive and know the depth. Eat and know the taste. Then you can discuss me to your heart's content. Develop truth and love. Then you need not even pray to me for granting you this or that. Everything will be added unto you unasked. Wonderful discourse. One of the earliest discourses I think you find in the Satya Sai Speaks also. So this was the discourse that Swami delivered in Nellore, right?
In Guduru, year, in Nellore district.
Right, 25th of July, 1958.
Actually, after this, we have another discourse that Swami delivered towards the end of that visit when Swami went to Venkatagiri. That's on the 2nd of August, 1978. So, seeing the time, we have 20-25 minutes. Prem, do you think we should go into another discourse or we discuss the article by Dupati Tirumalacharya?
Sure, so I think we can do that. We can come back to this discourse again.
The next week, the
right,
next time.
Right.
So that's what we'll do, dear listeners, because, you know, just like we love to eat a banquet with different varieties of dishes, Swami's discourse itself is a variety-filled dish in itself. But having discussed one discourse, we will keep aside the next discourse for the next week and go through this article called Divine Grace by Dupati Tirumalacharya.
Right, which incidentally is no less than a discourse. Right, it is as...
Yes, it is possibly heavier. It is possibly heavier. But, yeah, don't get scared away, dear listeners, because before going into that heavy stuff, I think we will go into some amazing bits of information for those who are not aware, like me and Prem, where we were only semi-aware of this particular person who has written the article. That itself will build in us some kind of reverence and respect towards the content that is being written. Who is this Dupati Tirumalacharya? You know, he is a spiritual sadhaka to the fore. Apart from being a genius, a Telugu pandit, a vidwan, a scholar, he had engaged in spiritual pursuit since 1910. And from 1910, which means he is in physical age much senior to Bhagwan. He was the Asthana Vidwan of Venkatagiri. Asthana Vidwan meaning a person who is the in-court scholar.
Right.
Recognized by the king, and if there are any debates that have to take place with challenges from scholars from other kingdoms, this is the guy who will stand up and defend the king.
And it was a very beautiful tradition in those days. Where you would get royal patronage for your art. If you belong to that kingdom, you did not have to worry about making money. If you're a scholar, if you're a musician, if you're a writer, if you're a teacher, you did not have to worry about making money, even doctors for that matter. You would have royal patronage, which means you would get a stipend or a salary, whatever you would like to call that, from the royal court. And as you said, you also make your appearance in the court whenever there is a a debate and all of that. But you do not have to worry about money. It's a huge thing in those days. You know,
why those days, Prem? I'm telling you, recently I met one, shall I say, Akka.
Mm-hmm.
Her name is Mani Rao, Mani Rao Akka.
Okay.
You can just search her on Google. She's a world-renowned poet, writer, and most cheering thing for us is that she's a devotee of Bhagwan.
All right.
And when I met her and I was asking her about writing, because, you know, I feel that I also want to improve my writing and all this, she told one very, very important point. She said, you know, writing should always be your passion and hobby. It should be something that your heart wants to do. I'm saying this, she said, I'm saying this because for many people, writing is a way to earn a living. And she told, the minute earning a living comes into your writing, the purity of your writing will be lost. Because you will now start writing in a manner that will earn you more money. And she said, I didn't want to do that. She has, you know, recently a book of hers has got published called The Living Mantra, where she has actually gone to different, you know, her thought is so beautiful. I don't know if this is a digression, but it's definitely a very interesting and insightful digression. Because she says, the Vedas are called Apaurusheya, meaning not written by anybody. And those seers, they are the seers, they are mantra drashtaras. Those have seen the mantra, you know. So she says that if it's an eternal thing, we should be having mantra drashtaras even today. Why is it that Vedas are not complete then? Because they're happening every day, they can happen anytime. So are there people who live the mantra? That's why her book is titled The Living Mantra. And 4-5 spots in India, she has gone and herself spent months and years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's a very academic work. So possibly it's definitely not recommended for light reading. But if you are able to go through the academic nature of the work and find the experience are really phenomenal and it's really gone deep. And so she was saying that her earlier career, you know, she was with Star TV Network and she's the one who started off a couple of channels for different networks, including having a big hand to play in the Vee Music Network, if you remember. Mm-hmm. It was there in the early days. So she said, I did all that because I wanted to ensure that when I genuinely want to write, I don't have any financial pressure on me. She said, I have earned a truckload of money, I've kept it aside, and now I can wholeheartedly focus only on writing, and I write without caring whether it's a commercial success, whether it's a bestseller, I can write the truth. I said this because not just about those days or the early days, for any art to survive, I think that purity is necessary. And that purity cannot get tainted with desire to earn money or desire to earn fame or recognition. That has to be kept aside. And that's why I think the kings of yore did a great service, not to these people, but to the art form itself, to poetry itself, to dance itself, telling that you pursue your art with all your heart. You don't worry, your meals, your clothing and your shelter will be taken care.
Right. And in the past, if you look at some of the most standout kings and rulers of India, they are people who actually, you know, pinpointed or they recognized some of these people and gave them that patronage. There were different kinds of kings, you know. There are some kings who would want these poets and singers to come and sing their praise.
Mm-hmm.
You know, you always find that also. And that's where you have, you know, the episodes where saint poets like Tyagaraja refuse to go to the court of the king.
Mm.
Even though, in fact, the king who calls Tyagaraja to the court is not one who falls in that category.
Mm.
He was a genuine devotee, but you know he
just wanted Ramakatha in his location,
in his court. Mm. Right. In fact, same thing happens even with Shivaji Maharaj. You know, he wants Tukaram to come to his court, but when he comes to know that Tukaram is not Sant Tukaram is in no way interested in coming to the royal court, he says, "Then I should go."
Mm.
Right, because that was their nature. They really wanted to go and be in the company of these people, and that is why it's a beautiful tradition. Like all beautiful traditions, this also had a certain amount of erosion and corruption happening there. But nevertheless, you can make out from the way Dupati Tirumalachar was, you can make out the nature of the king who gave him the patronage.
Mm.
Right? He must have been such a great scholar, such a great devotee. And by having him in his court, it shows what a great ruler and king the Raja of Venkatgiri himself was.
In fact, you know, Dupati Tirumalacharya is the person who has written the Sri Satya Sai Baba Ramayanamu. This is information that we got, and I really don't know where is this. It would be wonderful to get to read that. He has written the Sri Satya Sai Baba Ramayanamu. He has written the Sri Satya Sai Shatakamu and the Sri Satya Sai Gita. And Swami has made him read out all these three during 3 days of the 1960 Dasara celebrations. So he has not only composed this on Bhagwan, he has got the opportunity to offer it to Bhagwan during Dasara in Bhagwan's presence. And of course, he is most famous and popularly known for his composition of the Sri Satya Sai Suprabhatam.
Right.
You know, every time we wake up in the morning and think of Bhagwan, in a way, we are also offering our gratitude to Dupati Tirumalacharya for having put in words and vocalized the feelings that should arise in us as soon as we get up in the form of the Sri Satya Sai Suprabhatam.
Right, and of course we've done an extensive series on the Suprabhatam itself. Mm. But as someone was telling recently, the original Suprabhatam written by Tirumalacharya was much longer than the one which you are using now.
Oh.
So these are paragraphs that Swami has picked and approved, and Swami said that you can sing this.
This much is enough.
This much is enough, right? So that is Swami's stamp on the Suprabhatam that we sing for him. And of course, we spoke of how Swami was the one who also tuned the Suprabhatam, or who was there when the tuning was happened, and Swami fine-tuned it. So really a great devotee who had that opportunity of offering to Swami something which has become a part and parcel of Prashanta Nilayam Mandir, right? Mandir activity. So many of these works, hopefully we'll get to lay our hands on them sometime. Mm. But even to find find one of your works to have this kind of an acceptance by Swami, I think it's such a great blessing.
You spoke about how Swami accepted his work. I think the story of how he accepted Swami is also very, very interesting. I think
that was the first time when Swami had gone to Venkatgiri, 1950, as we've gone through in the Satyamshivam Sundaram series and all of that. 1948-49, the Raja of Venkatgiri comes to Prashanta Nilayam for the first time, Puttaparthi for the first time.
Mm.
Before that, he has darshan of Swami in that Bull Temple Road in Sakama's residence.
Correct.
When Swami is staying. After that, he comes to Bukkapatnam for the inauguration of the school.
549, I think.
Right.
It is.
And then in 1950, for the first time, Swami goes to the palace of Venkatgiri. And when Swami is visiting, actually, Tirumalacharya is not there. So that is when one day Swami asks the Raja of Venkatgiri, you know, where is Dupati Tirumalacharya? And the Raja is surprised because no one has spoken about him to Swami.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, Swami, he has taken leave from the royal court and he has gone to his native town, but he has not yet come. And thereafter, Swami describes why he has not come. Swami says, yes, I know he has not come because there are floods in this particular place. He is held up in this place for 3 days.
Mm-hmm.
And now he is coming. And Swami said, a particular date, I think tomorrow or day after, Swami said, he is going to reach the palace. And exactly like that, he reaches. And even as he reaches the palace of Venkatgiri, he comes to know that Swami has inquired about him. I mean, first of all, he comes to know that Swami is there. Somebody like Sai Baba is visiting, and then he's inquired about him. And Swami has also said exactly what has held him back. So he's completely surprised by that. And after that, when Swami speaks to him, I think that interesting dialogue, Swami asks him about some statistics that he maintains about the kingdom.
Being a scholar.
And being a scholar. Swami asks him, what is the average age of a citizen, average lifespan of a citizen in the kingdom of Venkatgiri? And I think he says 55 or something.
56.
56, he says. And then Swami says, I know that it is 56, but your lifespan will be much more than that. In fact,
he lived till 80.
Lived till 80? I think 100, is it?
He lived till 80 is what that source said.
But in a discourse when Swami was talking about people who have lived their life
to fullness,
Swami quoted the life of...
Oh, yes. I think he lived till 100. He definitely lived till 100 because he was 90 when Swami went to Badrinath.
Right, that's what Swami says.
In the 60s when Swami went to Badrinath, he was 90 because we know that 1910 he started his spiritual Deeksha and all that. When when he got to know that Swami had said that he had got stranded in a flood, he went to meet Swami, and Swami walked straight to him actually, and Swami embraced him and said, "I am your Devi." And it is said that when Swami released him from his clasp, Tirumalachar saw not a boy with fluffy hair, but he saw the mother goddess whom he has revered and worshipped all his life. That's how he instantly became a devotee. And Swami had also materialized a pendant with a Devi on it and given to him. But many, many were his experiences with Swami. During their visit to Ayodhya in April 1961, in the Rama temple, you know, that is now being constructed in a grand fashion at Ayodhya, the Ram Janmabhoomi temple. But in that little temple there, Tirumalacharya was blessed with a vision of Swami holding the bow and arrows, like, you know, with a golden head crown. That vision was too much for him to take, and Swami was in that yellow colored silk, standing like Rama. You know, he just fell down unconscious, and Swami had to tell the people what had happened, why he became unconscious, this is what has happened. And when he gains back consciousness, he's telling the same to the people, that this is what happened. You know, to know that what has happened to him, revealed by Swami and then by Tirumalacharya in the same manner, it must have been such a thrilling episode. So he had multiple such beautiful experiences. Little surprised that he continued to stay in Prashanthinilayam. And in fact, I think on the 14th of January 2000, Swami actually spoke about Tirumalacharya in his Shankranti discourse. And I'll just read out what Swami said. Swami says, Tirumalacharya, the author of Sri Satya Sai Suprabhatam, used to live here. He had served in the royal court of Venkatagiri. He was a great scholar in Sanskrit and the Shastras. He accompanied Bhagwan to Badrinath at the advanced age of 90. Bhagwan asked him whether he was fit enough to undertake such an arduous journey. He affirmed that with Swami by his side, he would travel any length of any journey without any discomfort. He said, Sai Mata, if you forsake me, my entire existence is a waste. If you accept me as yours, it is as if I have everything at my command. This was the state of bhakti and surrender in which Tirumalacharya spent his life. He was constantly meditating on Sai Mata. That is the thing.
Right, Devi. Mission of Devi.
He spent all his time in Swami's proximity, whether it was here or in Vrindavan. His bhakti was beyond measure. Consequently, his end was peaceful. He very well knew that his end was approaching and one day expressed his feelings. On being questioned as to how he knew about it, he replied, "Swami is telling me from within." He went for his bath, brought some water, washed Swami's feet and sipped a few drops of the sanctified water. And then he said, "Swami, my life has found fulfillment. Purnamada Purnamidam Purnat Purnamudachyate Purnasya Purnamadaya Purnameva Vashishyate. The whole is all that. The whole is all this. The whole was born from the whole. Taking the whole from the whole, what remains is also a whole." Physically, mentally and spiritually, he attained this wholesomeness. And now the time, he said, "Now the time has come for me to merge in you." Thereafter, he cast off his mortal coil and merged in Swami. So, that is the soul who has actually written this article, a few snippets of which we will go through now.
Right. And it's essentially, you know, what Swami speaks about, the nature of the individual or the Jivatma and the relationship to Paramatma. Again, it's a very, very true to what Vedanta says, very true to what you would find in scriptures like Bhagavad Gita and, you know, the other Upanishads. He says about how the avidya, what we refer to as Maya, is also created by the Lord himself. Mm. You know, oftentimes we think of God as the giver of vidya, and avidya seems to be coming
enemy.
From enemy and coming from nowhere. You know, but this is what the Bhagavad Gita also says, where Krishna says, Krishna very fondly refers to Maya as Mama Maya. He says, "It is my Maya. It has been created by me," and Swami, he says, "it is divine." He said, not for a moment think that it is anything but divine. It is also divine because it is created by me. And Tirumalachar writes that it is an assurance given by the Lord that this avidya is what causes all the trouble. The avidya is what causes delusion. But there is one certain way to overcome that, and that is by surrendering to the feet of the Lord. And it is to remind us of that, he says, that Sai Bhagwan, as he writes, I think that's the term that he uses to refer to Swami. He says he has come to remind us that is the only way you can overcome this. And of course, he speaks about the concepts of Kshetra and Kshetrajna.
In fact, he says that our individuality is constituted by two, the Kshetra and the Kshetrajna. Kshetra is the body, field, that is the body, and Kshetrajna is the occupant of the body. And he says, since we identify with the former, that is the Kshetra, that is the body, and not the Kshetrajna, we are subjected to all the sorrows. In fact, he seems to be telling us that avidya is also, avidya meaning maya or ignorance, is also a gift of God. And when you are able to identify yourself with the Kshetrajna, meaning if you are able to identify yourself with the indweller and not the body, then just like God enjoys avidya, we will also be able to enjoy the avidya. He says that the drashta enjoys the drishyam. Drashta meaning the Lord, the eternal witness. Drishyam meaning the scene, the big show. He says the drashta enjoys the drishyam. And it is avidya which offers him inexhaustible leelas. Just like, you know, it is a movie or a drama script, which is totally false, which is not true, which is unreal, which is not happening. But it is a source of such entertainment for us. Be it a tragedy, be it a comedy, be it a horror, be it an action movie, whatever it is, everything is false and yet it is entertaining. That is why we watch a tragedy and enjoy it, because it's entertainment. And it becomes entertainment only because we know that it is unreal and we don't associate with what is unreal. Same way, he says that if we are able to associate with the Kshetrajna and not the Kshetra, then we will be able to escape the Maya. And for that, he says the easiest way is to take refuge at his lotus feet. Once you are at his lotus feet, Maya will not touch you, because Maya is very dear to the Lord, meaning the Lord is also very dear to Maya. So whoever is dear to the Lord, Maya will not touch and harm. You know, you said that how Krishna says, Mama Maya, my Maya, like that. So Maya also has that same love for the Lord. I mean, Maya has the same love for the Lord is not something that the scholar is writing in the article, but he writes that if you take refuge at his feet, you will be freed from Maya. And he says the best thing about having Swami as our master is that he gives us personalized prescriptions based on each sadhaka's grade or level or degree. It's not like a one path fits all, one size fits all. Depending on how much strength we have, how much we have progressed, Swami tailor makes a perfect path, a personalized path for us, which we will enjoy and benefit the most. And that's why he says this is a great good fortune that has come on us, and we should love Swami. He says we are the children of the mother, and that mother Sai will never leave us. So again, here in the article also we can see his attachment to the Devi form of the Lord, granting him the darshan of which Swami became his divine mother. So this is in brief the beautiful article that has been written by this beautiful being.
Right. And at one point he says that, you know, he calls attention to one of Swami's discourses. I think he says, "O seekers after truth, what more do you require? We have the fullest assurance from the Lord." He said, the Lord himself comes and says that, "I am going to grant you. You just have to do this." Sometime back, I was going through a discourse, I think 1964 or 66, one discourse. Swami is addressing the devotees during some festival. The last statement is so profound. Swami is ending the discourse by saying this. He said, "When you go back to your towns and cities, tell people you have found the way to liberation. You have found the secret." Have that confidence, because you have come to me, you're on the path now, right? There is no turning back now. There is no missing this opportunity. So Swami says, with that confidence, go back and tell, I have found the secret to liberation. Right? So Swami says that is the confidence that it should give, and that's exactly what Tirumalachar says. And these are words of, I mean, if you really look at it, as you're saying, he was 90 during the Badri trip. Hmm. And Swami was in his 30s, right? Late 30s, mid-30s, in fact. So, I mean, that would have been a different kind of a relationship. I know that's one thing, you know, when you look at Swami, you think of age. Even though we came to Swami much later, we never looked at Swami and said that Swami is so old, right? That never came.
There are many of my friends who called him as their best friend.
Right.
Who can...
So that is the range, you know, you're looking at this period when here is a 90-year-old sadhaka who looks at Swami and is able to say, Mother, right? He says, Sai Mata, and he says, he feels so reassured hearing Swami's words. I think that is the eternal nature of Swami, that, you know, the age of the body never mattered at all.
Absolutely. And on that note, dear listeners, we will conclude today's afternoon satsang. There is still another little article, and as I said before, there is another discourse that we had promised we will go into, which we will be going into during the next week. The week after that, as we already said at the beginning, will be a new schedule with a new program that we will be initiating. But in order to accommodate that new program, the afternoon satsang, not from the next Thursday, but the Thursday after that, which is the 8th of October, the afternoon satsang timing will shift to 12, from 12 o'clock to 1:30, instead of the standard 12:30 to 2 that we are doing now, just a half an hour advancement. So, on that note, we offer this with all our love at the lotus feet of our dearest and most beloved Swami. We'll end with a song, on the other side of which you'll be greeted by Brother Chandu in his segment, Love to Love. Thank you. Jai Sairam.